She wants to be our first woman president. But is Hillary Clinton the right woman for the job?
Her politics are a relic of the early 90s, the Democratic Leadership Council, the centrist, business-friendly, tough on crime, aggressive foreign policy style of Democrat, which, whatever its value in the early 1990s, is now completely irrelevant. We live in a very different world, and Hillary, she has a very long history of being very friendly to power, to money, loving the military. And these are the last things the United States of 2016 needs.
That's journalist Doug Henwood. We spend the hour with him talking about his new book, My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency. It's out from Verso Books. This is Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and on writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. We're now in the final countdown to the Iowa caucus and the real start to the election season. As we produce this show, Hillary Clinton is running neck and neck with Bernie Sanders in the latest Iowa polls, and the race is tightening even in the national polls. The success of Sanders' campaign in mobilizing enthusiastic swaths of the Democratic base has clearly pushed Clinton to the left. She's touted her progressive bona fides on abortion rights and gun control, and has even gone so far as to call Sanders the establishment candidate. Clinton has flipped on positions, like her earlier support for the TPP and the Keystone XL pipeline. But she continues to be burdened by her long record of support for Wall Street, her close ties to the health insurance and drug industries, and her hawkish stance on foreign intervention. That includes not only her vote to support the war in Iraq, but also recent and ongoing conflicts in Libya and Syria and tensions with Iran. My guest, journalist, economic analyst, and radio host Doug Henwood, has delved deep into Hillary Clinton's record. In 2014, he wrote an essay about that record for Harper's Magazine, which he's now expanded into a book titled My Turn. Henwood makes no bones about the fact that the essay and now the book are broadsides against Clinton's bid for the presidency. But unlike other such polemics, which have largely come from the right, Henwood critiques Clinton from the left. Grounding himself in a close reading of her record throughout her long political career, he finds little to trust in Clinton's progressive claims. And he's deeply troubled by the powerful ties she's developed with the world's corporate masters, ties that have enriched her and Bill Clinton's fortune by millions of dollars. Doug Henwood writes frequently about economic affairs. He publishes the newsletter Left Business Observer, is a contributing editor at The Nation, and host of the weekly radio show and podcast Behind the News. He's the author of three previous books. Well, Doug Henwood, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Oh, good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Your book, My Turn, its cover shows Hillary Clinton with a gun aimed right at the viewer. It was a pretty controversial cover. Why did you choose this cover? How did it come about?
Well, I met the artist who painted that, Sarah Soul, on Facebook, and we just got to be a casual friend. She used to live in New York and listen to my show when it was on WBAI here. And I found her Hillary paintings fascinating. She's got a whole series of, I don't know, 30 or 40 of them on her website, of paintings and collages of Hillary alone with her in various configurations and modes of dress and undress. And she, by her own admission, has an erotic obsession with Hillary Clinton. She dreams of her and thinks of her, and obviously has a very passionate, fantastic relationship with Hillary Clinton. And I was very intrigued by it. I obviously don't like Hillary very much, but I was intrigued by someone who could develop such a passion for her. So when it came time to choose a book cover, I suggested to my publisher, Colin Robinson of Orr Books, that he take a look at Sarah Soul's work. And he chose that particular one. We talked over several other options, but that's the one he chose. And what it's based actually on a fairly famous photograph of Natalie Wood holding a gun. So that's the pose is very much evocative of Natalie Wood, who is not very much like Hillary Clinton. What I found fascinating about it was the intensity of Sarah Soul's feelings for her and the way it is, if you don't like Hillary, I think it makes you think of her bellicosity and ruthlessness. If you do like Hillary, and some people who like Hillary actually like the cover because it makes her look so tough in a nice way, in an appealing way. So, but it, I thought what's interesting is it brings out something about the emotional intensity of people's reactions to Hillary, both positive and negative. And people saw it as sexist, which I don't really quite understand. And I like to think there's nothing sexist about the book itself, but a lot of people thought that I somehow was playing to right-wing narratives about Hillary. I didn't feel I was. I was trying to go to great lengths to avoid doing that, but some people thought so. But I thought it's a... book cover is supposed to capture people's attention and start conversation, and I think it did that for sure.
You call this book a polemic. You're pretty open about that. And, you know, there's been a lot of books from the right wing against Hillary Clinton. I haven't read any of them because I couldn't trust where they were coming from, basically. Yours, I found a really great read, short, to the point. But why should we trust you on Hillary Clinton?
Well, I think it's a polemic, but it's also, I think, a very well-documented polemic. It's heavily footnoted just because people might be skeptical of my veracity. And I think there's nothing in there that wouldn't survive fact-checking. It's all completely factual rendition of her history. I will admit that I chose facts that are going to make her look bad. I don't really like her very much. I think she is personally untrustworthy, and as are many male politicians. And I don't want to single her out for being, you know, somehow uniquely bad, because that does play into that right-wing narrative and that the misogyny, which is, you know, certainly haunted her whole life. But her politics are, I think, a relic of the early 90s, the Democratic Leadership Council, the centrist, business-friendly, tough on crime, aggressive foreign policy style of Democrat, which, whatever its value in the early 1990s, is now completely irrelevant. We live in a very different world, and Hillary, her long history, she has a very long history of being very friendly to power, to money, loving the military. And these are the last things that the United States of 2016 needs. We need something that's more conciliatory, reconstructive. We have an economy and a society that's fraying and structurally very deeply troubled, and she is not the right person to address those issues. She's really, I think people don't appreciate how conservative she is at heart. And she's got this reputation for being some sort of, like, I don't know, bullshit lesbian feminist separatist or something, but she's not at all. I mean, she's a Midwestern Methodist. She's got a deep moralizing streak, and she's also... obviously, Wall Street likes her a lot. They paid her a lot of money for speaking fees. They've contributed a lot to her campaigns over the years. She and her husband together have raised between $2 and $3 billion from corporate and rich person interests over the years. So she's obviously sound from their point of view. Yet people project all these fantasies of her being a great progressive and she's going to be like the reincarnation of Eleanor Roosevelt or something, when she's nothing of the sort. And I think it's very important to look at her record, because she will say anything. I've actually looked at very little of what she promises in this campaign, because I don't believe a word of what she says. I've just read her history, her record, and I don't like what I see. People can read the book and see what I lay out. It's all there in considerable detail, although it's a short book, and draw their own conclusions. But you know, she is not the second coming of Eleanor Roosevelt.
I would imagine that people might come back at you saying that, well, she's evolved. You know, let's look at her stance on gay marriage, for example. And I heard, Terry Gross really grilled her on that, because, you know, she was against gay marriage and for DOMA, and now she's changed her tune. So what would you say to those people who say, well, isn't she allowed to evolve? After all, Bernie Sanders is evolving on guns. Why can't she evolve and change her positions?
People can be allowed to evolve. I think people can change their minds. I don't trust her change of mind. I think it's pure expedience. I think she's reading the mood of the Democratic electorate now, which is more progressive than what she when she entered the world of politics, certainly the big time with her husband becoming president in the early 90s. The Democratic base is more progressive. I think the broad population is more open to a different way of thinking. And she's trying to run to catch up to that changed environment. But based on her history, you know, there's just no reason to believe what she says now. Like I said, she'll say anything that comes into her head at any minute. You know, remember, of course, there's all these crazy stories, like when she landed in Bosnia under sniper fire. She's just not a trustworthy person. So I prefer to look at her history rather than her rhetoric. Somebody said on Twitter, and I wish I could remember who because it's a good line, and I could credit the person, but said she's got... Everybody talks about her experience. This is supposed to be her great virtue, yet we're not allowed to look at her record. You know, so we're just supposed to accept the experience, but not look too closely at it.
Well, let's look a little bit at that record now. You mentioned already that on foreign policy, she's a hawk. You spend a fair amount of the time examining her early career in politics. And in doing that, you've already mentioned that she comes from a conservative background, but she also was more of a progressive in the very early time. In fact, she even wrote her thesis, was that right, on ACORN, on Saul Alinsky. So it's ironic to me that both she and President Obama seem to, you know, be pretty familiar with community organizing, and yet they've been such elite politicians.
Well, her thesis on Saul Alinsky was sympathetic to a certain point, but she thought he wasn't, that the real way to change things was from the inside. So she didn't like that kind of militant outsiderhood. Now, Alinsky's an interesting character because the right also studies Alinsky, and you know, they've learned a lot from him. So I wouldn't say that Alinsky is just that's the self-evident proof that that she's a great progressive. But even then, you know, her advisor on that thesis said that you know, she always wanted to keep her distance from that style of politics. And then she decided, instead of following in the community organizing footsteps, she decided to go to law school. And not just any law school, but Yale Law School. So, I mean, she's Wellesley, Yale. I went to Yale myself, so I'm not in very much of a position to criticize people for doing that. But she and her husband were both born into fairly modest circumstances. He far more modest than she. But they use these elite institutions to climb the American social ladder to a position of extremely, you know, the summit of power. And she's not really interested in challenging that power. She's interested in taking part of it. And she did have that in her early days. She did go work for the Children's Defense Fund briefly. She was early friends with Marion Wright Edelman. They had a split when she endorsed Bill's end of welfare bill. But she was, always an insider type. You know, we're going to change things from the inside. We're not going to cause trouble on the outside. And the way you get real serious social change is challenging things from the outside, not by working from the inside, because the inside always has better perks than the outside.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with journalist Doug Henwood about his latest book. It's a critical analysis of Hillary Clinton's record. It's titled My Turn. So you mentioned the split with Marion Wright Edelman over the welfare reform bill. Hillary enjoys, I think it's fair to say, a fair amount of support among the black community. I wonder if you could talk about her policies towards poor women, not all of whom are black, by the way, but it's certainly a higher percentage of black women suffer poverty and their children suffer poverty than percentage of white women. So I wonder if you could address where she's been on this and where do you think that she is still?
The support among black community for both Clintons is a mystery to me. I don't really understand it. But given her history, Bill's history as well, I mean, and I should say that they're very much a shared project. When I started doing the research into Hillary from my Harper's article last year, no, in 2014, I didn't realize how much of a joint venture they really were, but they really were. I mean, they have very complementary temperaments and styles of thinking, and neither of them would have gone anywhere near as far as they did without the other. And I would say that true of them, both of them equally. They're very much an equal partnership. But let's go back to your question. She has a very problematic history with black people and black women in particular. One, I'm thinking of when she was the First Lady of Arkansas, Bill gave her the task of managing the reform of the educational system in the state. And one of the things they decided to do was a competency test for teachers. The teachers union became the enemy and they became the target in this attempt to reform the Arkansas educational system. Now, Arkansas's problems are deep-rooted in poverty and just in isolation, and the school system reflects that. But they decided they were going to blame the teachers and go through a competency testing ritual. This disproportionately affected black women. The teacher corps in Arkansas at the time was disproportionately black women, and the competency test was, and the targeting of teachers in particular, was, in a sense, a war on a largely black female workforce. When they did the competency test, the failure rate, according to what they had planned to grade the thing on, was about 50%, and they realized they couldn't fire 50% of the Arkansas teaching force. So they had their pollster at the time, Dick Morris, poll on what would be an acceptable rate of failure. And they discovered that 10% would be an acceptable rate of failure. So they decided to, like, fail 10% of the teaching force. But, you know, that was a really ugly campaign. And I think, you know, laid the groundwork for a lot of the things they would do in the future of like, being anti-union, of like stepping on the New Deal coalition, Bill in particular, but this is a very New Democrat thing. And Hillary was very much part of the invention of the New Democrat ideology in the early 90s. So the anti-union, anti-labor, anti-public spending, that whole package, they were both pioneers of. And then to move on, there, of course, was the two horrors of the Clinton presidency, the 1996 crime bill, which just greatly lubricated the whole machine of mass incarceration, which was disproportionately affected black men by just adding so many more categories of crime, mandatory minimum sentences, and encouraging the states to follow suit. It was just part of this juggernaut of punishment, increasing punishment, and putting more and more people behind bars. And Hillary cheered that on. She like used all the rhetoric of gangs as super predators, all that fashionable rhetoric at the time, and talking about how we need more people behind bars. She supported the three strikes and you're out kinds of things. And then, of course, the welfare reform, the end of welfare, which one of the things that Bill campaigned on, end welfare as we know it. She supported it, in part because Morris told her that it would be good for his Bill's popularity ratings and re-election potential, but also because, again, going back to that moralizing streak that she has, she used language like deadbeats to refer to women on welfare. You know, like they were just sitting around doing nothing. And that, you know, almost, you know, highly punitive Protestant view of the world, the work ethic and the judgmentalism is very much part of her personality. But those two things, the crime bill and the end of welfare, have had a horrible effect. They're two of the worst pieces of legislation from the point of view of black Americans in modern times. And she supported both of them. And even as late as 2002 or three, I think 2002 it was, in one of her first memoirs, she praised the welfare reform and said it was a great success. And of course, it's anything but we now have many, many millions more women in poverty than would be if AFDC had continued. But she praises a great success then, and then she praised the crime bill also. Until recently now, both she and Bill have gotten born again on mass incarceration. But, you know, she's, in some sense, she's trying to position herself as running against her husband's record, which she supported almost all the way through until very recently.
Yeah, and other issues that are really close to the heart of women. What about her position on abortion rights?
Well, yeah, that's one of her big selling points now, but she's always like any good New Democrat, like her husband, they always want to split the difference. So, for example, one of the phrases that she's used over and over again, I don't know if she's used it lately, but she's used it many times over the years, is that abortion should be safe, legal, and rare. And certainly safe and legal, no question about it, but rare concedes much too much to this stigmatization of abortion. Why? I mean, it's, and she uses terms like a private tragedy. It's just, why concede anything when she was a senator from New York State? So it's, you know, relatively recent in her political history. She praised the efforts of the religious right to promote abstinence education. Like, so why does she do these things? I think it's a combination of pandering to the right, which she always likes to do. And we're starting to see hints of that in this current campaign, despite her channeling Eleanor Roosevelt. But also, I think that moralizing instinct is never far from the surface with her. She is a classic pursed-lipped moralist. And that's one of the reasons a lot of people don't like her. They may not know that in detail, but I think people pick up on that, that icy judgmental quality that she has.
She also has used language, as you point out in your book, Doug Henwood, as you point out in My Turn, which is your polemic on Hillary Clinton, that she's used language around partial birth abortion and banning late-term abortions, that she's pandered to the right on that as well.
Yeah, I mean, there is a way in which she wants to give aid and comfort to these pro-lifers who are, in my book, the enemy of women.
Now, we haven't talked about her, what she's probably most famous for, and that is being Wall Street senator. She herself said, I represented Wall Street, being the senator from New York. Talk about Hillary Clinton as a senator, Senator Hillary Clinton, and what that tells us about where she would be as a president if she were elected.
Well, her Senate career, there's not much that to say about it. She didn't really accomplish that much. She was more of a seat warmer than anything else. But we discussed earlier some of the right-wing books about Hillary, and most of them are crazy, and I deliberately avoided reading them. I read one after I finished my book, just because for amusement, Ed Klein's latest, which is just a horror. But there's one actually quite good book coming from the right. Daniel Halper, who is an editor at the Weekly Standard, wrote a pretty good book, Clinton Inc., he calls it. It's about an examination of the money and the philanthropy. But he talked to a lot of Republicans who served with Hillary in the Senate, all of whom had good words for her. They all liked her. Even Newt Gingrich praised her. She went to the family, that Christian prayer group in D.C. Jeff Charlotte has written about this. And she made friends with people like Sam Brownback. You know, Brownback is a Catholic, but these right-wing Christians in the Senate, she was very close to them. A couple of Halper's sources said that Hillary got along better with the Republicans than she did with her fellow Democrats.
That's quite a statement, given how much she's talked about how the Republicans hate her.
Yeah, well, they, you know, politics is, you know, so much of it is an act. So they act like they hate her, but apparently in private, they get along quite well. She made a point of actually befriending some of the leaders of the impeachment movement, the impeachment resolution. So, and she went out of her way to do these things. She went out of her way to get into the Armed Services Committee. That was the first thing that she wanted to get to as soon as she got to the Senate, was to be on the Armed Services Committee. Her most notorious action as a senator was to vote for the Iraq War. And on that, of course, she was not the only Democrat to vote for the Iraq War, but she actually took a position closer to the Bush administration on the relation between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda. She said there was actually a relation between the two of them. She said, well, they weren't responsible for 9/11, but they were friends.
And actually, he hated al-Qaeda.
Yeah, and you know, Kenneth Pollack, who is National Security Advisor to Bill Clinton and also has worked with Hillary, said, we told her this was BS, but you know, she went for it anyway. I don't know why she had to say that. You know, a senator from New York is not at risk of losing re-election because you don't take a position to the right of Joe Lieberman, but that's what she did. She deliberately did not read the CIA's National Intelligence Estimate on Iraq's weapons capabilities because it showed, unlike the sanitized version that was released to the public, the classified one showed that Iraq almost certainly had no weapons of mass destruction. She didn't read that. Now, that's very out of character for her. She reads everything. I mean, she's really extremely well-informed, a really hard worker. But she decided not to read it, one presumes because she didn't want to know the facts, so she could vote for the war without being troubled by any evidence. So that's her most notorious vote as senator. She also voted for a bankruptcy reform bill, which several years earlier, Elizabeth Warren had briefed her on that, the whole move to reform the bankruptcy laws. American law has historically been very friendly towards debtors. This bankruptcy bill, which they made several attempts to pass them in the 90s, never made it, but it finally got passed during the early 2000s. She voted for that one. Warren had briefed her on why this was such a bad idea, and Warren said Hillary agreed at the time, but she changed her mind somewhere along the line and then voted for the bankruptcy reform, I presume because she was representing Wall Street. Wall Street doesn't want people to make it any easier on people to be relieved of their credit card debt. She is now pretending to be a big proponent of regulating finance. It's another reason I don't want to believe a word she's saying now because, well, actually, most of what she proposes is pretty minor tweak. She's making them sound like a big deal, but they're not really. And none of the things she's proposing make Wall Street people very uncomfortable. And most of her friends on Wall Street know she has to say these things to get elected. So they don't believe it. So there's no reason anyone else should. So yeah, she's a bellicose, a friend of the army. When she was Secretary of State, she took positions more aggressive than the Secretary of Defense, the Republican, Robert Gates, several times. And she's the top diplomat, being more of a warrior than the Secretary of Defense. So she is, friendly with big money and friendly with the military-industrial complex and is happy to lob around cruise missiles. And for all my reservations about Obama, I don't think she would have done the deal with Iran that he did. I think she's itchy to tighten the screws on Iran again and to reverse this trend towards warmer relations that the Obama administration has been leading for the last several years.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Doug Henwood about his book about Hillary Clinton. It's called My Turn. So this is kind of scary because we already know as Secretary of State that she had a part to play in, the destruction of Libya, basically, the descent of Libya into a totally chaotic and rogue state or lack of state, concerned about Iran, concerned about what may be coming up if she becomes president. Why do you think that she is such a hawk that is even to the right of, some Republicans?
That's a good question. I don't know why. She was a Goldwater girl in 64. Now, I should admit that I was a conservative in my early days in college, and it didn't last. But she does have those tendencies, let's say. But why? I don't know. It's probably a mix of the environment she grew up in. She was extremely anti-communist as a kid. She had this right-wing teacher who was a strong influence on her. But as to why it persists now into this very different world, I don't know. But her instincts are very, very hawkish and consistently so. She had a piece in an L.A. Jewish newspaper the other day in which she was arguing for taking U.S.-Israel relations to the next level, whatever that means. I don't know how they could get any closer, but I guess she wants them to be closer. She is far friendlier than most Democrats are to Netanyahu. Most Democrats are certainly loyal supporters of Israel, but they tend to be closer to the Labor Party. She's friendly with Netanyahu. And also in this piece, she argued for a tougher line on Iran. And she said we shouldn't rule out military action if they don't play along with the nuclear agreement. So she never stops. When I interviewed Dick Morris when I was writing the Harper's piece in the summer of 2014, I said, well, how's she going to handle the Obama legacy? And he said, well, and Morris, although he's a bit of a crank sometimes, is also a very sharp political thinker when he's not being cranky. He's capable of moments of great insight and then capable of moments of great delusion. But he'd also knew them for 20 years. So this guy really knows the Clintons very well. So I said, how's she going to differentiate herself? And he said, well, she's going to say, Obama talked a nice game, but you need somebody who can get things done. That's what I am. But also, she's going to differentiate herself on some foreign policy issues. And in particular, he mentioned that Obama didn't arm the Syrian rebels early and aggressively enough. And sure enough, 2 weeks after Dick Morris said that to me, she gave the interview with Jeffrey Goldberg, The Atlantic magazine, in which she said Obama didn't arm the Syrian rebels early enough. So that's her instinct, is that I think Obama is just too peaceful for her. Obama, who's like, we've got military operations in something like 130 countries around the world now, drone strikes all over the damn place. But, that's not enough for her. She wants to put the squeeze on Iran and arm the Syrian rebels. And, seems to have learned nothing from that experience of Libya, that, taking down a government, as horrible as Gaddafi was, taking it down with nothing to replace it just makes things worse.
Hmm. Doug Henwood. We'll talk more with him about his book, My Turn, Hillary Clinton Targets the Presidency, after the break. This is Writer's Voice, and I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Stay tuned.
Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. Everyone is crying out for peace, yes. None is crying out for justice. I don't want no peace. I need equal rights and justice.
Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today with journalist Doug Henwood about his new book, My Turn. It's an in-depth examination of Hillary Clinton's record. Henwood questions whether Clinton is as progressive as she claims, as she runs against a strong challenge from the left. Now, another area, just recently she has attacked Bernie Sanders on single-payer health care, saying, you know, how is he going to pay for it? And in fact, last night as we do this interview, I saw an interview on MSNBC with Howard Dean, in which Dean claimed that Howard Dean has long been a supporter of single-payer, but he said he's supporting Hillary because it's the more practical solution. So when you said, just spoke about the pragmatism that she claims for her foreign policy, it sounds like she's also going to be taking that tack on things like healthcare reform. So I wonder if you could talk about Hillary and healthcare reform. We know it goes way back to when her husband was president, and where she's come to now. And then tell us, do you think that's a more pragmatic place to be?
Well, I think Howard Dean is actually now working for a lobbying firm that works for the healthcare industry. So that might have something to do with his opinion. The idea that this is somehow pragmatic is weird to me. The American healthcare system is massively inefficient. We spend 15, 16, 17% of GDP, depending upon which accounting you read, on healthcare. Most other countries spend a third less or even less than that. The Brits spend half as much as we do. The French and the Germans spend maybe 10% of GDP on it. So we have an massively inefficient healthcare system that doesn't cover everyone, even with the ACA. It still doesn't cover anywhere near, like still have 10% of the population uninsured. People are finding more and more that health insurance companies are shifting more and more costs onto them. So even if you have insurance, you may find yourself saddled with enormous bills. The whole thing is incredibly complicated. It's impossible. And I've spoken with experts who've been covering healthcare, following healthcare issues for 20 years or more, who find the whole system incomprehensible. And it's designed that way. The way that like the exchanges are set, the web exchanges are set up, it's deliberate so you can't do comparison shopping. They want to make it as obscure and difficult as possible. So the whole system is massively expensive, inefficient, doesn't cover millions and millions of people. And even those who are covered are subject to great financial risks. The insurance companies are tightening the provider networks all the time, so you have a smaller and smaller selection of doctors. I don't understand how this is either efficient or just by any measure. It's unique in the world, and it's insanity.
But they're arguing that because of the political clout of the insurance companies, it would be impossible to get single payer. So that Hillary's incremental approach to improve Obamacare, although she hasn't really given any specifics, would be more pragmatic.
Well, part of the problem in the American political system, one of the great problems of the American political system, I should say, is that we assume that you can't really change much of anything. So we do all this incremental stuff, and you just end up in a worse situation than when you started. Medicare works very, very well. Almost everybody on Medicare loves it. It's enormously popular. Its administrative costs are far lower than the private system. It's universal, it's simple, and it works very, very well. Why can't that be offered to everyone? Yes, the insurance companies wouldn't like it. The drug companies wouldn't like it. But screw them. They're terrible, terrible parasites, and they should be put out of business. Well, the drug companies can't be put out of business, but the insurance companies should be. And the drug companies should be, and the medical equipment companies, and all the hospitals, and the whole racket needs to be gotten under control. And to think, oh, we just can't do that is such defeatist nonsense. I don't understand that there's an instinct among a lot of Democrats and liberals that because of the current political environment, we just can't do anything. So let's just do a little tinkering here and there, but we can't really challenge everything. That's not the way politics works. I mean, if we look back what the right wing did, and having been on the right many years ago, I understand this from the inside. In the early 1970s, when I was on the right, it was an extremely weird position. We thought we were in a losing battle and that the collectivists were going to take over and we'd be the socialist United States of America in 20 or 30 years, or maybe even sooner. But that didn't stop the right from a radical challenge to the way people do and what people do and think. And I don't know, like, there's something we learn from that. Just make strong demands, be principled. And, Republicans in Congress are insane, but they actually have a set of principles they believe in that they'll fight for. I can't say the same for Democrats. They're so divided in their loyalties, they have to, you know, pay tribute to the business interests that fund them. At the same time, they have to appear to be, you know, the popular party at the same time. So that creates all kinds of weird contradictions. But there are also so many, even like liberal intellectuals who are not necessarily having to deal with those material contradictions, are unwilling to make anything like a radical proposal. Why not? And, you know, part of the problem is, I think, the decline of the far left over the last 20 or 30 years means that liberals don't have anything to appear as a reasonable alternative to. They don't have anything to dilute, to water down. So the liberals can't get anywhere without a left really pushing things. But that all aside, I mean, the healthcare system is just a screaming example of how screwed up things are and how we need a serious challenge, a really serious overhaul. And we're not hearing anybody except Sanders talk about that, any prominent personality in politics talking about that. And to hear Hillary's criticisms now, which have been getting stronger and louder in the last couple of weeks, she is really, it's almost as if she's ready to tack to the general election of appealing more to the center, to the right. But she's like painting Sanders as some sort of reckless tax and spend guy. She sounds like a Republican. And she's saying, well, I don't know about this revolution. It makes me worried. And I think part of that is an act, and part of that is really who she is. And it's distressing that anyone would fall for it, although there seems to be a backlash against it because some of what she's saying is so obviously dishonest. And Chelsea now has gotten into the act, too, of lying on her mother's behalf.
Talk about the money, though. Are there some connections between Hillary Clinton and the healthcare industry?
Well, there are some, but the foundation and her campaigns and her husband's campaigns have gotten money for all kinds of business interests. And I think the business interests in blocking serious single-payer kind of healthcare reform is not necessarily about the healthcare just itself, but they don't want the American public to get, as they like to say, a new entitlement. They don't want people to feel like the government owes them anything. And if they get one thing, they might ask for another thing. Now, Sanders is running more or less as some kind of American version of a European social democrat. Like, he's looking for a much more generous welfare state, a much more tightly regulated capitalism, and a much more generous welfare state. And I think business interests and rich people can see that, and they don't want anything like that. And a single payer, because it would be... If Medicare, in its present form, were extended to everyone, it would be a massively popular reform, except with, you know, maybe insurance companies. It would not be popular in the area around Hartford, Connecticut, probably, but, you know, elsewhere, it certainly would. And I don't think they want that example more generalized. Social Security, too. It's massively popular, extremely efficient, extremely successful program. It would not, of course, be instituted in the present. It took the New Deal to make that happen. But they don't want anything like that. They don't want to create a sense that, you know, that in the American public that they actually deserve something for their taxes other than an intrusive, inefficient state and foreign wars.
What is Hillary Clinton's position on Social Security?
Vague. I mean, she talks about strengthening it. When people like her talk about strengthening it, I think that means cutting it. But she is not very honest about or forthcoming about what her plans were. But, you know, look at Obama. He appointed the Bowles-Simpson Commission to work on the deficit. And that was his idea. And he picked these two guys who were notorious for wanting to cut Medicare and Social Security. And that was strengthening it and making it secure for the long term. I think the long-term intention of people like Obama and these sort of centrist Democrats like Hillary is to turn it into more of a welfare program for poor people and that the rest of the population would be forced to save and to provide for itself in retirement. This is a very, very, very bad idea. It doesn't work. Most people don't have the money to save for their retirement. Social Security is a marvelous system. It should be expanded, not cut. But I think that Hillary would probably fall along the lines of that Bowles-Simpson line of you know, using different price indexes to adjust the cost of living, making it perhaps means tested over the longer term, but turning it into more of a welfare program and more something targeted on poor people than on a universal program for everyone. People like Hillary hate universal programs. They don't want this sense that everyone is entitled to something because you're a human being. They want you to earn it, have to fight for it, and be tested, and pass the test. And it's not a vision of the kind of humane society I'd like to live in.
You just mentioned before, Doug Henwood, you mentioned the Clinton Foundation, and there's some very interesting parts in your book, My Turn, your book about Hillary Clinton, about the Clinton Foundation, just how much it has accomplished or not accomplished, how it's run, and the ties between it and some pretty huge foreign donors, foreign corporations.
Yeah, I mean, if you were not, let's see, I have to be discreet so I don't get sued, but it looks like kind of a shakedown operation, really. It's a way of getting money out of rich people and corporations who want to have influence with, you know, then senator, then secretary of state. You know, of course, the former president is a real charmer and gets people together. But what it's accomplished, and the donors are domestic corporations, large corporations, rich individuals, foreign governments, and foreign corporations. And a lot of the foreign donors, curiously enough, don't do anything in their home countries. They're not known for their philanthropy at home. But they give money to the Clinton Foundation. Why is that? I think it's because they wanted to get on the good side of the Clinton family for obvious reasons, because there was a senator, there was a secretary of state, and a possible future president. Maybe if we count Chelsea, another, you know, who knows where she's going. But what they actually accomplished is it's pretty thin. It's an unusual foundation in that they don't really give out money on their own very much. They put people together. So they look, for example, for a corporation that needs some good PR, and then they find some worthy cause, and they put them together. And they all get together and slap each other's back on the stage at these annual Clinton Global Initiative events. So it's a way of for rich people to feel good about each other and what they're doing in the world, and for people to make connections. But, you know, if you look at their work, one of the things they're proudest of, and the people who the Clinton fan club loves to tout, the work they've done on AIDS in Africa. And they've done some half-decent work. It is very small. It does not help very many people. And curiously, one of the things they've done is negotiate down the price of drugs. A good thing. I will concede that. But the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton administration, actually had driven up the price of those drugs with its trade agreements and intellectual property protections. So, you know, in some ways, they're undoing the bad work that Bill did as president. But if you compare what the foundation has done with what, you know, and it's odd for me to be saying this, but what George W. Bush did with his AIDS initiative when he was president, there's just no comparison. Bush's initiative, which doesn't really get the credit it deserves, mobilized scores of billions of dollars and saved many, many, many thousands of lives in Africa. But that's the kind of thing you can do when you have a state, the scale of a state and the skills and scope of states to mobilize those sorts of financial and human resources can actually, when they're done right, can do a lot. A private foundation can't do anything like that. It can do little pilot projects or demonstration projects, or, you know, we're supposed to set a great example. But, you know, when you actually look at what they do, it's not so consequential. What the foundation did in Haiti, there's a fairly long passage in the book about long passage for a short book about what Hillary as Secretary of State and Bill and the foundation did in Haiti, and it was grotesque, absolutely grotesque. And it's kind of hard to separate who was doing what. It was very much, a joint venture of Bill and Hillary operating as Secretary of State and Foundation head through the reconstruction of Haiti after the earthquake in 2010. They built a garment factory with some really, really miserable housing next to it to house workers. They supplied really defective, poisonous trailers for temporary housing, which were the same, made by the same company that made the poisonous trailers that were sent to New Orleans after Katrina.
The FEMA trailers.
Yes, the FEMA trailers, which incidentally were built by Clayton Homes, which is owned by Warren Buffett, a good friend of the Clintons, and somehow has a reputation as a decent billionaire when in fact he's anything but. And they built some luxury hotels in Port-au-Prince. The State Department built luxury housing for the embassy. So you get this poisonous trailers, substandard housing, a garment factory, which, you know, has provided nowhere near the number of jobs that they promised it would. And Hillary had pledged that they were going to build Haiti back better than it ever was before, and they did anything but. What they did in Haiti was truly grotesque, and they haven't really gotten anywhere near the level of scrutiny and criticism they deserve for it.
And moving somewhere in the same region, a little bit, shifting a little bit over west of that is Honduras. Now, of course, that's under Obama's administration that the Honduran democratically elected President Zelaya was overthrown, but Hillary was the Secretary of State at the time. I wonder if you could say a little bit about what might have been going on there, and whether that also might have had any impact on the kind of immigration that we are seeing of people fleeing Honduras now.
Yeah, it was interesting to see her in that black and brown, wasn't exactly a debate, it was a serial interview, that Fusion ran recently, that she was talking about the tragedy of Honduras and all the dislocations there. Well, she bears some responsibility for that. When she was Secretary of State, the U.S. government, and she was deeply involved in it, supported quietly, discreetly, the coup against the elected president, and then ran out the clock so he couldn't really get returned to power. So they made all these gestures towards like trying to undo the coup, but it was completely fake. They were just running out the clock so then there would be a successor. They didn't like him. Now, President Zelaya emerged in the Honduran elite, and it was kind of a surprise that he turned out to be a fairly progressive guy, but the Honduran business world did not like him and wanted them out. And perhaps by coincidence, the old Clinton friend Lanny Davis was working as a lobbyist for the Honduran Business Association. And in some of the released emails that the State Department releases every Friday afternoon, it was shown that I believe it was Sidney Blumenthal was suggesting getting Lanny Davis involved in like the diplomacy around the Honduran coup when he was at the same time a lobbyist. But you know that's how the Clintons work. They pretend in public to be great friends of democracy, and that in private they're working with business interests to be anti-democratic.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Doug Henwood about his book, My Turn. It's about Hillary Clinton. Hillary's big claim now is that she is more electable than Bernie Sanders, that even if you may like Bernie Sanders more than her, it would be a wasted vote and we can't get, you know, the crazy Republicans in. In 2008, you point out in your book that Harry Reid encouraged Barack Obama to run against Hillary because he thought that she held too much risk of electoral catastrophe. Do you think that's changed in 2016?
Well, I think we're seeing recently her slide in the polls suggests that the more people see Hillary, the less they like her. There is a small group of people who love her, but there are a lot of people who really don't like her, sometimes for the wrong reasons, sometimes, you know, like I said, like there's right-wing lunacy around her that I want no part of. But she, I think people can feel that she's not trustworthy. And that you just cannot believe a word she says. And there's something also, you know, politics, unfortunately, or not, maybe not, I don't know, but to a large degree is about personality as well as policy. And people find her personality very unappealing. Unlike her husband. Her husband was just a masterful politician. Say what you will about Bill. I mean, the guy could charm a crowd. He could charm anybody, whether one person one-on-one or you know, millions of people on TV. The guy was a genius, an absolute political genius. And Dick Morris said that in private, their personality is kind of reverse, that in private, when there's no crowd around or he's not campaigning, Bill goes blank. There's not much going on there. Mm-hmm. But Hillary in a small group, and I've heard this not just from Morris, but other people as well, that she can be very, very charming, witty, and likable. But as a public figure, she's not. She's wooden and says things. She blurts out things that cause her trouble later, in part because she's not comfortable the way Bill is as a campaigner and as you know, relating to people in the way politicians have to. But the slide that she's had in the polls, I think, confirms the fact that that there's something that people just don't like about her. And if you look at the history of her approval ratings, it's a long history of Hillary approval ratings. Her highest rate of approval was when she was when Bill was getting impeached. There was a great deal of sympathy with over the Monica Lewinsky stuff for her, understandably. Although a lot of her supporters just demonized Lewinsky in the most vilest ways. It was revolting to watch what they did with Monica Lewinsky. But the more she's in view, the more her poll ratings go down. And she started 2008 as the front runner. And as soon as the Obama challenge grew, she sank. And she fought to the end. She fought well into June. But I think it was pretty clear, you know, a few months after the primary started, that she was not beloved. And there's a high risk of that now. And when I started doing my research for the Harper's article, which then got turned into this book, I talked to a bunch of people who liked Hillary. And I said, aren't you a little worried about putting all your eggs in one basket? You know, she's got this history of not being very likable, of being people turning on her the more they see of her. She's got all these scandals. The email scandal, you know, Bernie's damn emails comment aside, is a real thing. Mm-hmm. And who knows what else? There's, of course, all the old Bill Clinton era. I don't think anybody really cares about that much anymore. But then the stuff with the foundation is really smelly. And it wouldn't surprise me at all if a lot of those deleted emails have something to do with the foundation. And supposedly the FBI is investigating who knows what they might turn up. But there's a high risk that they could turn up something nasty. So here you have this candidate who is not beloved, who has a history of fading on exposure, and who has all these potential scandals that could blow up in her face. Why are you so uncritically supportive of her? Nobody could ever answer me on this. It's remarkable. And the damage of my soul, I've been, you know, immersed in Hillary Clinton for like the last year and a half now. And so I've read a lot of stuff about Hillary, and I'm struck by how few really persuasive, informed, positive cases for her, political cases. There's the experience thing, which is a mixed bag. She's a woman. Yes, she's a woman, but so is Margaret Thatcher. And she's inevitable. And people guard that inevitability very jealously because perhaps in the back of their minds they know that there are all these vulnerabilities. So if she loses the invulnerability, I mean, if she loses the inevitability mantle, she's dead. There are now cracks in that inevitability. That's why she's getting nastier and getting more devious. And this is only going to intensify if the polls continue to go in the directions they're going.
I don't think that's really going to help her, unlike maybe other politicians who can slime others and get away with it. It seems to be a pretty high mountain to climb when Hillary Clinton, who's not likable to begin with, is sliming Bernie Sanders, who refuses to respond in kind.
Yeah, I was struck by the reaction of even very mainstream pundits to her lies about single payer, which are nothing but lies. I mean, she's like fear-mongering and lying about it in a way that you'd expect a Republican to do. And several, like even just straight news stories, said, well, that's actually not true. And that you don't always see that in news stories when politicians say things that are not true. But she has a long history of being very hostile to the press. She mistreated them. She treated them very badly when she was a first lady. She was responsible for shutting off press access to the West Wing, which, you know, may sound like a very insidery thing, but it doesn't make sense to alienate the people who are going to write about you. I don't understand why she did that. And then, like, early in the primary campaign, she had them behind a rope line. And she's walking down the street in New Hampshire. She had the reporters behind a rope, a moving rope, to keep them a fixed distance from her, so they couldn't ask her any questions. So I think there's a reservoir of ill will towards her in the press corps. And once they see an opportunity to go after her, they're going to. But also the lies were so egregious. And then getting Chelsea into the act was really smelly. And so far it hasn't worked out the way she's hoped. And Sanders' contributions went up fourfold in the days after they started lying about the single-payer scheme. So it's amazing how much money that guy's been able to raise. Mm-hmm. I have problems with him. He's not my ideal candidate, but it's very refreshing to have somebody like him out there saying things that no other American politician has said in a long, long time. But also, the contrast between their style and personalities is very interesting. The more people see Sanders, the more they seem to like him. The more they see Hillary, the less they seem to like him. I was amazed by the talking heads on the fusion debate recently. All these young people, most young people of color, who were just really pleasantly surprised by how compelling Sanders was. And he said, well, Hillary, I don't know. We don't really like her, you know. And, you know, she's the younger. She's 5 years younger than Bernie. But, you know, they treat Bernie as if he's the breath of fresh air and her as this relic of the 90s. It was striking. And I think Sanders has not gotten that much coverage on TV. I think Trump gets more coverage in an afternoon than Sanders has gotten in a month. But once he gets out there, and the debates are a way for him to get out there, people find him appealing, both in policy and personality. And to have somebody just that authentic, this old kind of gesticulating Brooklyn Jew personality, it's just so refreshing in the you know, the anal retentive world of American politics to see somebody like that with his ill-kempt hair and his, you know, inattention to style. I don't know. It's just. And then, you know, the substance of his campaign, it's just been an extremely pleasant surprise to see how he has been received, both as a personality and as his agenda as well.
I found that Fusion Black and Brown Forum was also very interesting because it started out with Jose Ramos, who it seemed to me that he was going right after Bernie Sanders at first. And it seemed to me that if I had to guess, I would say he was a Hillary supporter.
But his daughter works for Hillary.
Oh,
his daughter works for Hillary, I believe.
Okay, so then that even strengthens it. But by the end of Bernie's answer, by the end of the interview there, you could see that Jorge Ramos was listening carefully and liked the guy in spite of himself.
Yeah, well, it's like the combination of his the old Brooklyn, you don't see that much anymore, even here in Brooklyn. But also, I mean, the combination of his style and his seriousness and the fact that you just don't think that guy is lying. Now, everything that Hillary says seems censored and scripted and is carefully, carefully chosen. There's nothing spontaneous about her at all. People say that in private she is, but certainly not in public. Sanders is a politician. He's been a pretty successful one for 30 years, so he obviously knows how to play the game. But there's something just so honest about him, like him or not. I think that people find that appealing because they're just so tired of all the lies and the euphemisms and, you know, the deceptions that they're so characteristic of politics. It's just, he's a real breath of fresh air.
Mm-hmm. Well, Doug Henwood, breath of fresh air to talk with you today and to read your book. My turn. It's your polemic against Hillary Clinton, but I use that word in the honorable sense in which it was originally defined. Thanks so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice.
Thanks for having me. We can call it a broadside in the spirit of the 18th century.
There you go.
Thank you.
Doug Henwood is a journalist, economic analyst, and radio host who writes frequently about economic affairs. He publishes the newsletter Left Business Observer, is a contributing editor at The Nation, and host of the weekly radio show and podcast Behind the News. In addition to My Turn, he's the author of three previous books. You can find a link to his Harper's Magazine article about Hillary Clinton, out of which My Turn developed, at writersvoice.com. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.